Now, there's a second feature of this doctrine, too, that's important for us to come to some understanding of. In the West, we sometimes think that reincarnation is an opportunity to have something that we may have missed this time around. For a long time, I used to think of myself as a frustrated baseball player, as a shortstop in the making who really didn't have the physical skills or the body to go out and be a great success on the baseball field, and instead I had to settle for second best and become somebody who made his way by crawling from the tip of one grass blade to the next in the stacks of Widener Library at Harvard. And I thought maybe if I came back in another life that I could be that great baseball player that I wanted to be in this life. It strikes us that way. Why not? If we're reborn in another life, wouldn't we try to manipulate our lives in this world so that we could come back in a form that would be more attractive or more pleasurable to us? In India, for reasons that are important to think about, the doctrine of reincarnation didn't work out that way. It came not to be viewed as being an opportunity, but to be viewed instead as a burden. And part of the reason for this is that Indian civilization, in the centuries that began to lead up to the life of the Buddha, came to view reincarnation not as a single life or as two or three lifetimes strung together, but on a time scale that involved millions and millions of lifetimes. So that whatever those challenges were that you wanted to meet in some new life, that you wanted to come back in order to confront, perhaps to overcome, began to seem very small in the large scale of personal and cosmic history that you were involved in. One of the best ways to get a sense of the emotional impact of this idea is to consider one of my favorite stories. It comes out of a body of Hindu texts where stories are elaborated about things like the doctrine of reincarnation. It's a story about the god Indra and a Brahmin boy. The story starts like this. Indra has just won a great victory. He's actually slain a demon that held the waters of creation in its belly, and he has released the waters of creation over the world and begun to bring the whole process of set the whole process of creation in motion. And in order to celebrate this, he decides to build a palace, like William Randolph Hearst at San Simeon. He gets the divine architect Vishwakarman to design for him the most perfect throne room and guest houses and kitchens and palatial dining rooms and all of that sort of thing. And he builds and builds and builds so that Vishwakarman, the divine architect, eventually simply becomes tired of all of this. So he goes to the god Brahma and asks him for help just to cool down some of the enthusiasm that's driving Indra on this massive building project. Brahma manifests himself as a Brahmin boy, as a child, and he goes, like Nachiketas, to visit Indra in his palace, and Indra is required by the custom of that culture to provide lavish entertainment and a beautiful welcome for the child. So he brings out food and music and entertainment and all of that sort of stuff, presents it to the child, and the boy begins to weep. Looks down at the floor, and he breaks out into tears. Indra is stunned by this, so he looks at the boy, and he asks, "What's wrong?" And the boy points to a line of ants running across the floor, and he says, "Indra, each one of those ants was an Indra just like you in a previous life. And not just one time, but millions and millions and millions of times. And that will happen to you. You too someday will fall down from your position as the king of the gods, and you'll be an ant crawling across the floor of someone else's throne room." And Indra, of course, is stunned by this new vision of himself in this vast scale of time in which even the most extraordinary achievements eventually decay and slip away.